I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last month, a Cleveland grand jury decided not to bring charges against two police officers in the shooting death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who was waving a toy gun. He was shot more than a year ago, and the incident was captured on videotaped. It showed him being shot, lying on the ground wounded, and his sister being tackled by one of the officers as she ran towards her brother. The county prosecutor, Timothy McGinty, said the death of Tamir Rice was an absolute tragedy, but it was not, by the law that binds us, a crime. That decision has sparked protests and confusion and raises questions about grand juries, especially in the age of cell phone videos. How grand juries work, whether they have outlived their usefulness, whether they give prosecutors too much power, and when they are appropriate. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Seth Williams is the district attorney of the city of Philadelphia. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always a pleasure to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you here. I should also add an adjunct professor at Penn, Villanova, and Temple University. Also with us is David Rudofsky. He's a civil rights and criminal defense attorney in the law firm practice of Carey's, Rudofsky, Messing, and Feinberg. He's also a senior fellow at Penn Law, and he's written a lot about police misconduct. And David Rudofsky, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning.
It's a little weird talking about the Tamir Rice case because there's so much that we do not know.
Sure.
But Seth, we have seen, I mean, if people care to, you can watch this videotape, which I have watched, and you see the shooting of this 12-year-old boy. He's shot within about a second or two of the police pulling up to where he is. He's outside. He has something in his hand, clearly, and it turned out to be not a real gun, but some kind of a toy gun or a facsimile of a gun. Does this case raise questions for you?
Well, first of all, it's a terrible tragedy.
Absolutely.
Regardless of what you think of grand juries or the law, the loss of life in this situation, a young child who was in a playground doing what we'd hope children were doing, playing in a playground. But I think what we have to, one, kind of separate is our reaction to what the grand jury did and also recognizing what the law is. And so, you know, I'm not familiar necessarily with the law in Ohio, but in Pennsylvania, we have a specific rule. And when I am considering bringing charges against a police officer for having used the excessive use of force, we give police officers batons and weapons, and there's a different standard. People often will say, well, if I had done that, they would have charged me. So I think it's important for your listeners to know that I first would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the police officer was unreasonable in using the level of force that he or she did in a certain situation, which is separate and distinct from whether or not the DA, the prosecutor, decided to use a grand jury or not. So I think we need to start with that.
Well, I'll get back to you, but let me get you in on the conversation, David. And I mean, this is one case. Obviously, there are many cases. But does it raise questions for you?
Well, yeah, there are serious questions here. And when you say to start at the beginning that the grand jury refused to indict, I think that's not quite what happened here. Sure, they did not indict, but they did not indict because the prosecutor controls the grand jury. The prosecutor in this case, Mr. McGinty, has said it. He didn't think there was enough evidence for him to bring this case to trial. So this was not an independent judgment by a grand jury. He decided what evidence to present. He decided which experts to present to that grand jury. Remember, the prosecutor controls the grand jury completely. There's nobody else in that room. The prosecutor decides what evidence to present, how to emphasize it, and whether to suggest to the grand jury that there be an indictment or not. So to the degree that there should be criticism here, and that you can argue on both sides of this, whether there should have been an indictment, right, and whether this should have come to trial, we can talk about that separately. I think it should have. But putting aside that, this was a prosecutor's decision. And so I think a lot of the criticism is valid, that it was his decision, and then he kind of creates the facade of a grand jury and saying, well, 12 citizens or 24 citizens decided not to prosecute. That's not what happened. It was the prosecutor's decision.
And just to follow up, and then, Seth, I'll get back to you. But isn't that true in all grand juries, essentially, that prosecutors decide the witnesses, they decide the evidence?
That's right. And we'll talk, and Seth has mentioned, that there's both indicting grand juries and investigating grand juries. They have different functions. But either way, prosecutors pretty much control that process. Doesn't mean it's an illegitimate process, because they do so. But the history of grand juries and the function in the states that have them today and in the federal government is to allow the government to use that to either investigate possible crime or, where it's required, to return an indictment.
One of the criticisms is that, to you, Seth Williams, is that prosecutors and police are often you know, on the same side of a particular issue, and that there's just a too much of a close relationship between police and prosecutors, raising questions about whether prosecutors can really prosecute police officers.
Well, I think that is a valid question. I think there's always that tension. We have lots of tensions in government at every level and every example. I take very seriously, however, the role that I have as the prosecutor and the role of the guardian. So Plato said almost 2,000 years ago that it matters not if the mason or the cobbler fail at their work, but if the guardians fail, then the democracy will crumble. So the public really looks to see how police officers, how prosecutors do their job. If people think there's no law, there's lawlessness, then the democracy will crumble. So I think we do have to review each other, and we have to police each other. But I take very seriously, and I'm very proud of the fact that we've cut down the time for us reviewing cases when police are alleged to have committed crimes almost in half since I've been the DA here in Philadelphia. And we've charged more people since I've been the DA, police officers, than my predecessors, my two predecessors, Castile and Lynn Abraham, put together in just my 6 years compared to their 24. But every case is different. And I think I'm glad to be here with Professor Radofsky. I think at some point we need to talk about the differences between indicting grand juries and investigatory grand juries. And yes, they are tools for prosecutors to determine whether or not there is enough evidence. And that's the role that the DA has. It's my job. You know, people watch Law and Order. Right, the first half hour is there's a crime and police do things, but the second half hour is what happens in court. And the redress that the public has is if they think that I'm not doing the right thing is to not reelect me. That is the check on what the DA does, or when jurors go and sit in cases to say not guilty.
Well, let me go back to you, David, and going from Plato to Judge Saul Wachter,
right.
But he famously said that, grand juries, by and large, they have so much power. Let me do the correct quote. Said the district attorneys now have so much influence on grand juries that, by and large, they could get them to indict a ham sandwich.
No, that's the famous quote.
That's the famous quote,
right,
yes.
Right.
I mean, it's a little overused, but nonetheless.
No, I think it's right. And I think I want to put two other issues out on the table. One is when you think about the case that we're talking about with the DA McGinty and not prosecuting in that case, a lot of people say if that wasn't a police officer, there surely would have been a murder or a manslaughter charge. It is true the law is different with respect to what police can do. They can use deadly force in situations where I cannot. But when you look at all those facts there, I think there's enough for a jury to decide as opposed to a prosecutor just to say, no, we're not going to go ahead with that. Beyond that, we ought to be aware that there are going to be very few prosecutions, just as a matter of fact, whether it's because of the relationship between the prosecutor and the police force, whether it's because of restrictive criminal laws, which makes it difficult, whether it's because of the realism that a lot of juries won't convict police officers. So a lot of that means that even in their situations where there was unreasonable use of force, we may not see a criminal prosecution. And that's why it's also important, and maybe even more important, for police departments internally to be disciplining officers, not to be hiring officers like this officer in this case, right?
Who apparently had a bit of a track record.
A terrible track record. Had been fired from another police department. Nobody checked, right? This is someone who had psychological problems that he couldn't even deal with in a small town police force. He gets hired, and you see what happened in this situation. So probably in terms of controlling misconduct, while the high attention is paid when there's prosecutions or grand juries, the day-to-day work internally in a police department in terms of training and supervision and ultimately discipline is probably much more important than the occasional prosecution.
You're nodding your head.
No, I would agree. And I had tremendous respect for Commissioner Charles Ramsey and the manner in which he ran his department and would terminate police officers after, again, they deserve due process internally. And he would ensure that. And when he thought it was appropriate, he would remove them from the force. Often they get their jobs back here in Philadelphia as a result of our civil service rules, which are it's a whole nother show for you. But I really respected the manner in which Commissioner Ramsey, his internal affairs, how he handled that. And I have all the utmost respect and expectation for Commissioner Ross to continue those same policies.
But why you know, there are trials that we're more familiar with because
sure.
we get they're open and we can go if we want, and the witnesses, the evidence, all that is out in the public. Grand juries are secret
sure.
in many ways. Under what circumstances do you convene a grand jury then?
That's a great starting point, really. And there are two different types of grand juries in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. For decades, we only had investigatory grand juries, which people are more familiar with. And often we'll use an investigatory grand jury when we believe that either there's so much information. You know, often there are cases where someone just gets robbed at gunpoint at 52nd and Chestnut. They call the police, 911, the police show up. It's a quick case. You put that before a preliminary hearing, it's easy, it's shut and done. You go on to the trial where the defendant has the absolute right to cross-examination, Sixth Amendment rights. There's some cases like the clergy abuse in Philadelphia, right, or a building collapse where there's so many different issues and documents and people that might not be willing to testify that I make the decision to call a grand jury so that we can have time to build a case, to see if a crime did occur, to see if anyone should be charged. Because sometimes people aren't charged as a result of a grand jury, which people never know about because we have to ensure the secrecy reasons. Because let's say we had all these grand juries, we're considering crimes, and the people, we don't bring charges against them. Well, they would ruin their reputation, just the mere fact that I have a grand jury going. And so that's one of the main reasons also that we have secrecy. But there's 24 to 38 Philadelphians that are part of the grand juries when we have them, and they hear the evidence. And while it's true, the prosecutor decides what witnesses, often the grand jurors will say to the DAs, well, we want this information. Bring us this. We want to know this. What are these facts? And we try to do that. So as an example, I watched the videotape of Lieutenant John Josie, who several years ago was at the Puerto Rican Day Parade.
I remember that videotape.
And I watched the videotape, and I saw what he did. And I made the decision, well, let's just charge him with simple assault. Now, the FOP was mad that I charged him at all. Some members of the community were mad that I didn't charge him with felonies, but I thought I did the right thing. Now, there'd be other situations that there was a Sergeant Ellison and Chauncey Ellison and his girlfriend, Robin Fortune, who were police officers, who shot someone while he was off duty. And my predecessor didn't bring charges, wrote a letter not bringing charges. But there was issues there. What actually happened? Who saw what? Who were those witnesses? Were they being intimidated? Did they not want to come? So I decided to put that before a grand jury. And we ultimately received an indictment and convictions for those two off-duty police officers for the murder of that victim. So there are a lot of different types of cases. Police officers, I had a press conference where there was a victim, Najee Rivera, who was stopped by two police officers. He was on a scooter, and they tried to stop him, and he took off. He was beaten. And so there was questions. A lot of police officers showed up. Did they want to testify? Did they feel threatened? So that's the type of case I put before a grand jury. Ultimately, they were charged.
Well, I know you want to say something, David, and there's much more to talk about. We do have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about grand juries in this hour of Radio Times. The voice you just heard is Seth Williams, district attorney for the city of Philadelphia. Also with us is David Rudofsky, and he's a Philadelphia civil rights defense attorney. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with David Rudofsky and with Seth Williams about grand juries. They have their roots going back many centuries to English law. They've been used in this country for centuries, although not in every state, and it often varies from state to state. They do operate in secrecy and have come under criticism recently in some cases involving police shooting. We have called up police shootings, I should say, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David, I know you want to respond to some of the things that Seth was saying right before the break.
So it's important to focus on the grand juries. The investigating grand juries will investigate police officers. They may investigate people in the church. They may investigate other situations. And it's certainly a legitimate tool where prosecutors need the subpoena power to get the information. On the other hand, we have a history in this country of abuse of that process. The prosecutor controls it. The prosecutor decides what evidence to present. And in fact, a number of courts have said even if the prosecutor has exculpatory evidence evidence that would indicate that the target of the grand jury was not guilty, they don't have to present it. All they have to do is present enough to present probable cause to the grand jury. So there's always that danger. And it's not only the potential danger. We know of cases in which innocent people were indicted, where evidence was withheld from the grand jury that maybe would have led them not to indict. So whenever you have somebody in that kind of control, you want to be careful and you want checks and balances. And we don't always have that with investigating grand juries.
Well, how do you do – I mean, are you saying, David, that they have outlived their usefulness or they should be used more judiciously or –
I think they can be a legitimate tool. Sometimes certain kinds of crimes, particularly complex crimes, white collar crimes, very difficult to investigate without a subpoena power, which prosecutors otherwise don't have. But every time you give that kind of power, we know that that kind of power, where it's kind of absolute in that institution, can be abused. I'm not accusing anybody here of abusing that, but we know of that historically. And the other side of that is people have legitimate questions because of that. Why is it in situations where police are being investigated, we find so few indictments, right? And that's where the tension comes.
Well, I think I'm glad again to be here with the professor. And if we're going to be on WHYY, where else can we be professorial, correct? So you talked about the evolution of the American jurisprudence. But nowhere on the global scene do we have prosecutors like we do in America. So the evolution here is unique in that we don't have national government prosecution, right? We have decentralized, locally elected prosecutors everywhere in the United States, with the exception of New Jersey, where the governor appoints. So that's important to recognize. We have decentralized, locally elected prosecutors who are chosen by the people they represent to bring charges. So the whole issue of do I bring charges, that is within the discretion of the district attorney completely. The issue of who's guilty or not guilty is an issue of judges or a trial jury. So the grand jury in no way eliminates the right to a trial by jury in the Sixth Amendment. But you have no constitutional right to how charges are brought. Mm. So the different methods are we going to have a preliminary hearing, which we do in some states. Some states also have grand juries. Some states have no preliminary hearings. Some states have no grand juries. But in Pennsylvania, we have had the investigatory grand jury for decades as a method for prosecutors to investigate. We also now have indicting grand juries, which as a result of years and people coming to us and saying that so many witnesses weren't coming to court because they were being threatened or intimidated. So I lobbied the Rules Committee of the state of Pennsylvania and the Supreme Court to create indicting grand juries, which we've done since January of 2013. And we brought over 1,600 cases that way, in which case victims would not have come to court because they were being threatened. And it allows them to come to court to testify before the grand jury. And then for the defendant, if there's enough evidence to be held for court, and then the defendant has the access to the notes of testimony and to cross-examination at the time of trial.
Let me go back to you, David. And there are certainly cases in this city and other places as well of witness intimidation or people just feeling like if I testify in court, you know, I could be in danger. Is there a role you think for grand juries in protecting those kinds of people?
Yeah, I think there's some limited role there where there's really absolute proof that somebody might be intimidated or threatened. I think it also can be overused. And recall what's happening in those cases. For most people who are charged, they get the right to a preliminary hearing in Pennsylvania, which means before the case gets to trial, the prosecutor has to present evidence in court before a judge. The defense lawyer gets to cross-examine. And as a result of that, sometimes those cases are dismissed properly. Right. There isn't sufficient evidence because the judge has said, I don't find even probable cause to take this case to trial. When you have the grand jury substitute for that preliminary hearing, it means the decision solely in the hands of the prosecutor. There is no right to cross-examine any of those witnesses before trial. And sometimes that can be an unfair process. And so, again, And it's what you've created here is a situation where it's totally in the control, really, of a prosecutor to decide which cases go to the grand jury. Sure, they got to convince a judge that someone's been threatened, but that's not very hard to do. The witness comes in, says it. They're not cross-examined about that. My point is not that that type of investigating grand jury is not proper, that investigating grand juries generally are not, that even indicting grand juries are not proper. But they're subject to abuse, and we have to be careful about that.
Can you appeal? I mean, if I'm thinking of the Tamir Rice family, can they appeal the decision made in Cleveland? Do you know, Seth?
Well, again, I'm not
I understand we're a little
Ohio,
bit out of your jurisdiction.
In Pennsylvania, if in fact the grand jury comes back with no indictment, I mean, I think the remedy is solely may possibly, of course, in civil court where they have a different, much different standard. Possibly the federal government can bring charges that there were civil rights violations possibly in federal court, in federal criminal court possibly.
Yeah.
But not in – they have no remedy in Pennsylvania. You know, again, there's always the possibility there's additional evidence.
Right.
And if there's additional evidence, then that brings – and it could shed light on something that a different prosecutor or the same prosecutor might change his or her mind. But I think, again, the use of investigatory grand juries or indicting grand juries is just a tool, such as in the Kermit Gosnell case here, where, yes, members of my office, detectives and Federal Drug Administration officers went in there.
This was his health clinic, abortion clinic.
He had a health clinic where they had a pill mill. But the investigation by DEA agents and county detectives into a pill mill led to them stumbling upon a gruesome, a horrific place in which women who should be insured their health rights pursuant to the laws of our country were being maimed and children were being born alive. Now, we can all have arguments and discussions about abortion, but children were being born alive, breathing, and then having their lives, their spines severed. And so we would not have been able to get all this information but for the use of a grand jury, bringing witnesses in, bringing employees in who, of course, did not want to testify. So the use of that, not only did it result in the indictment of Dr. Gosnell and co-defendants, but also led to the grand jury writing recommendations that have led to various state agencies changing the manner in which they do their business.
Going back to something you said, David, I mean, are you making the case that there's a place for a defense attorney in a grand jury? I guess you're not allowed inside of a grand jury, right?
That's right. Not there.
If
I represent a target, I'm not allowed there. Different states have different rules, even on consultation,
sure,
in terms of what goes on. I think at a minimum, prosecutors ought to be mandated to present exculpatory evidence. If I've got evidence that would indicate, for example, that my client did not do that particular crime, that evidence ought to be presented, or if the prosecutor has it independently. And there might even be some role in some cases for defense lawyers to be there, so you have a fair presentation. But on the police issue, there's a separate matter because I say few of these cases eventually get to prosecution. I mean, you can count them in the fingers of one hand, or often for a number of years. Much more important is the police investigation, and there we've got a tremendous problem in Philadelphia and across the country. When there's a police shooting and the police use deadly force, that's now investigated internally by internal affairs or by some special unit. And the police have all kinds of protections and that kind of thing that other citizens don't have. In fact, it's not rare in this city and across the country where if a police officer has used deadly force and may have used it improperly, that police officer won't even be interviewed by internal affairs or some other investigative group for months after the incident until everybody else has been interviewed. The officer knows what everybody else has said. It's completely upside down. If I discharge a gun, even though it might be in self-defense, I'm going to be questioned right away.
Mm-hmm.
The police are going to gather the forensics. They're going to be very strategic about when and where they question me. And that's going to happen right away before I know what other people are saying. When there's a police officer involved, we turn it around completely. And that leads to some unfair results at the end.
And that's David Rudofsky. He's a civil rights attorney, defense attorney here in Philadelphia. Also with us is Seth Williams. He's the district attorney for the city of Philadelphia. And we're talking about grand juries, their uses, their misuses, getting an interesting series of perspectives on grand juries. And an email from BN saying, could you explore whether police union contracts include protections against charging and convicting police misconduct?
No. So, of course, their collective bargaining agreements can't include that type of language. But Professor Rudofsky is correct in that many of the collective bargaining agreements for the police benevolence associations or the Fraternal Order of Police across the country do have specific rules about if there is a police-involved shooting, the timeline for when that police officer is allowed to be interviewed. And prosecutors and police chiefs around the country have a full range of opinion about that and the desire to change that. And so I think Professor Rudofsky was correct about that. But to your emailer, no. Of course, they cannot include language in a collective bargaining agreement mm-hmm. that the DAs won't bring charges or they can't be found guilty or anything like that. But so I'll have to explain that. But they do have due process rights that other citizens don't have at a similar stage.
Well, and that makes sense. I mean, in certain ways, because police officers are allowed to use their weapons in either self-defense or if they feel as if
have no problem with them using it in self-defense under the law to use it to protect people. Absolutely. A lot of shootings are proper. Nobody's saying that. And no problem, obviously, from my side with due process.
Right.
But it's super due process. We're talking about a level of due process and a level of review. And then ultimately, as was mentioned, arbitration processes, which give them much more protection. It's a little ironic, right? The police are always talking about technicalities that defendants are using to get off the Constitution, right? And yet when it comes to the investigations of police officers, they are the ones that request and get, as a result of collective bargaining agreements, super due process.
A tweet from Beth. This is to you, Seth Williams. Why haven't the tapes of Brandon Tate Brown been released? Is this part of your department?
Well, again, the death of Brandon Tate Brown was a tragedy, and this was a case in which a young man was pulled over by police. And most of these cases, again, while tragic, are the result often of people who are being stopped not just submitting to the authority of police. And this is an unfortunate situation where a young man got out of the car, began struggling and fighting, which is all on the videotape, and then still, instead of just putting his hand up, or even just running away, try to run back into the vehicle where he had a handgun lodged between the seat and the console. And the police officer had seen that handgun, and one police officer used his weapon to stop the defendant from getting to the weapon that was in the car. We brought the members of the community in to show them what we had. Different issues result about the use of, and it's going to be a huge issue in the future with police officers having dash cams, having to gather the information to be able to give it to defense, with making sure that people think that things aren't erased. There's just so much information. But again, in that situation, we would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the police officer who fired his weapon was unreasonable in coming to the conclusion that he had to use his weapon to stop Brandon Tate Brown from getting the weapon that was in the car that had his DNA on it. And there was multiple civilians that were there that watched all of this transpire. And there were video cameras from that neighborhood that had all this information. So again, while it was a terrible tragedy, it was something in which it was not criminal. There were no criminal charges I could have brought in that situation based on the evidence that I had.
It looks like you want to add something,
yeah,
David.
Right. And then, listen, I don't know the facts of that. There was an investigation. What we do know, and where we can lose, I think, respect from the community in these kind of situations, we look at Chicago, where they sat on that videotape for a year and a half, made a sweet deal with the family, right? Bought their silence in some ways. I think in this kind of situation there are witnesses who can talk publicly, right, and they do, with this videotape about this kind of incident, it seems to me except in the most extraordinary circumstances, which I'm not even sure I can put my finger on, that gets released. So the public itself can make the kind of judgment. You made the right call. You didn't make the right call. I think we want to be very careful. And it's in the future, it's going to happen. I think in 5 or 10 years in this country, most officers are going to be wearing body cameras. We're going to have a lot more information, which I actually think is a good thing. There are all kinds of questions about privacy and what we do with all that kind of information. But we have to realize we're now in that kind of age, right? Which is a good thing.
I agree.
Which is a good thing. And I think more disclosure is probably better.
And the idea of, I guess, with videotape, then we all get to see it, and then we all get to decide. I mean, does videotape tell you everything you need to know?
The defense attorney's always. I was a defense attorney a while. I'm in charge of the public defenders for the Pennsylvania Army National Guard. I have guard duty this weekend. I'll be a defense attorney this weekend. We'll always want more. Like if you have a videotape that shows a defendant giving the, his statement about what happened. Well, then what happened to 2 minutes right before you brought him into the room? What happened then? So there's always going to be more. But I think what's important, and the professor has identified it, is that we do need to – when I was running for DA the first time, I met with the mayor, the FOP, the police commissioner. Everybody wants us to investigate these cases quicker because those that deserve to be prosecuted should be prosecuted, and those that deserve exoneration deserve to be exonerated quicker. So we've cut the time since 2010 from about 132 days on average for the investigation of these cases to 73 days. So we've significantly reduced the time by putting more people to investigate those cases and more senior people investigating those cases because, again, the public really wants to know and wants to see that we're handling those cases appropriately. And in the upcoming month or so, I'm going to have an announcement about how we're going to have even more transparency in these cases. But there are rules. Like with the investigation I had into the lawmakers that were caught on videotape and audio tape accepting bribes for specific votes, not for taking gifts, but for specific, like, here's $2,100 bills. I need you to vote on this legislation. It'd be great for me. It would exonerate people who were mad at me because they think I did. If I were just to show the videotapes, the discussion would be over.
Right.
But there are
rules. But because it was a grand jury.
There are rules that prohibit me from doing specific things, commenting on things. It wasn't until one of these defense attorneys, Chuck Peruto Jr., had withdrawn a motion and that he had a motion on – it was racial targeting. He withdrew his motion. And then I was able to comment on what specifically related to his client that showed that there was no racial targeting. But for 2 years, I had to bite my tongue while people were saying all types of other things. So there are specific rules that prohibit the release of videos and audio tapes outside of the rule of law.
We are talking about grand juries in this hour of Radio Times. Seth Williams, the Philadelphia District Attorney, is our guest. Also with us, David Rudofsky, a Philadelphia-based civil rights defense attorney. And we have folks who want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we are talking about grand juries in this hour of the show. Our guest, David Rudofsky, is a civil rights and criminal defense attorney practicing with the public interest law firm of Carey, Rudofsky, Messing, and Feinberg. He's also a senior fellow at Penn Law. Seth Williams is with us as well. He's the Philadelphia District Attorney, adjunct professor at Penn, at Villanova, and at Temple University. And you can join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get David from Central New Jersey. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I believe that one of the common denominators in all the problems in the justice system and in law enforcement is localization. It's kind of astonishing to me that this country, even from the beginning, allowed people at local levels to be sheriffs, police, prosecutors. I think it should have all been originally a nationalized system, and you should not have been allowed to serve in the state that you're from. And I think that would have taken away.
Why, David? I mean, why? What's the problem with that? I don't understand.
I think the closer you are to a community, the more you have roots in a community, I think the greater the likelihood that you're going to be able to be influenced, that the greater the likelihood, even at a minimal level, that you're not going to be objective. But I don't even believe there should be state police.
Let me take your point, David. We don't want to get too far afield here, but
David, you make a good point.
Seth Williams.
I was lucky to receive an Eisenhower Fellowship to study the criminal justice system in Australia and in South Africa, where they have centralized criminal justice systems, where the Crown, right, the national government appoints prosecutors to serve. And so there's some merit to that. But I would also say, and I'm proud of our system here in America, that really springs from Quakerism, that we believe a crime is not against the individual, but a crime is against the peace, the dignity, and the tranquility of all of us. That comes from William Penn. And so we have directly elected local prosecutors because when I go to ShopRite, right, on Haverford Avenue, people come up to me and will tell me what they feel. They know who I am. They see me on TV. They listen to me on WHYY, and they stop me. And so there's some merit to that. To having a person who went to public school here, who lives like you do, who has the same problems, reacting and dealing, and to talk to me about issues. So there's merit to that. Now, I can also see people thinking, well, having elected people, having money in politics, it has a problem. There's no right or best way, maybe, or perfect way, I'll say. But I think there's a lot of merit to having locally elected prosecutors who are responsive to the community. And if the community feels as though that I'm not doing my job or there's some sort of issue, then they just get rid of you. As they can't do that if the Crown appoints you.
What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think the answer is just to have a national police force. When you think back over the history of this country and FBI abuses and abuses by the federal government, probably even more serious than we see on the local level. So
right. It's
not an answer just to have that national police force. Right. That's not going to solve the problems. I think there is something to be said that when you have elections for prosecutors and judges, politics come in. We've seen judges run on I've imposed 45 death penalties, right? So we get into that kind of that's a judicial election, which is different. I think with prosecutors, it's fair game. People can turn them out. On the other hand, when you think about the last 40 years in this country and mass incarceration and the misuse of criminal law, some of that is because prosecutors, when they run for office, have built on that, have said, I'll lock more people up, and that's what we've done, at huge cost to our society, both racial and other.
Mm. Right.
And so when it becomes part of that local political process, there's some good stuff. People are answerable. People can see me in the supermarket.
I think I'm the beneficiary.
Hold on. Go ahead.
But there's also the risk, and we've seen it played out in this country time and again, and I'm not talking about Seth Williams, but that a lot of prosecutors think they're beholden not to the whole community, but to other parts of the community, and we see some kind of decision-making which is questionable.
Mm. Yeah, well, I'm glad. You know, I think I am the beneficiary of this process. I wasn't born to millionaire parents. I was given up for adoption at birth. Lived in an orphanage, two foster homes. I ran against my predecessor. My theory was to be smart on crime. It's not about mass incarceration. It's about preventing crime and reducing recidivism. Well, I didn't win in 2005. I did win in 2009. I won re-election in 2013. I was the first African-American DA in the history of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. On these theories of trying to modernize and reform the criminal justice system. So still, we're not anywhere near being perfect. I got that. But you know, as a result of directly electing the DA in Philadelphia and me getting a plurality of those votes, I've been able to implement reforms unseen in our city.
Let me get looks like Marlene from Medford, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Marlene. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to share my experience as the four person, politically correct, of a grand jury a few years ago. It was an indicting grand jury, and I left that experience with annoyance, disgust, I don't know what. It was actually a presentation by the assistant DA of his case. He had made up his mind. There was no contrary opinion offered, and everything he presented was approved by the rest of the 15 people as to be indicted. Mm. And we were helpless to fight this avalanche of evidence on one side. And I left thinking, why do we have grand juries?
Well, that's interesting, Marlene. I'm glad you called in. Let me give David Rudofsky a chance to respond.
Yeah, and I think that's true for a lot of indicting grand juries, which is why, interestingly, a lot of states have moved away from the indicting grand jury and gone to preliminary hearings or some other process because they are somewhat meaningless. The federal government still has indicting grand juries because there's a constitutional requirement for that, interestingly enough, that the Seventh Amendment gives you, if you're going to be charged in federal court, you're entitled to an indictment by a grand jury. It doesn't give you a whole lot of protection in reality, but there's the constitutional right. But a lot of states have moved away, and certainly in the cases you're talking about, which are probably the run-of-mill cases, that's what's going to happen. There's no independent judgment. There's no other evidence coming in. It is what it is, and I'm not sure it's worth that time. On the other hand, as the district attorney has said, there are complicated cases where you might want the investigating grand jury, and there are some small number of cases where perhaps an indicting grand jury is more appropriate than a preliminary hearing where there is really strong evidence of intimidation or threats. That can be used as a backup.
I mean, we want confidence in our judicial system. I mean,
certainly.
It seems to me so that when decisions are made, the public can feel that justice was done. But Marlene is saying, you know, bad taste in her mouth from this experience.
Yeah. And I try to tell all of my assistant DAs that every contact you have with a witness, a victim, you know, that might be tomorrow's juror, or a juror could be a witness tomorrow. So you want to try to make sure that every contact is one that leaves them with a sense of the system works. Mm-hmm. And so again, you know, we have almost 65,000 arrests every year in Philadelphia. And so those that are felonies have the absolute right to a preliminary hearing. And if you were to go to watch preliminary hearings, it's like watching, you know, a conveyor belt. Mm. And just things are happening so quickly. So you would come to maybe the same conclusion if you just watched in a courtroom, for a municipal courtroom, what happens in, you know, there's just so much. If we were to give each case, you know, the hour that it gets on Law and Order, the whole system would come to a standstill. Now, people might say, well, we deserve that. Well, okay. The DA's office in Philadelphia has the smallest budget of the 21 largest counties in America with violence. So, okay, if you value that, right, well, then give us more money so that we can have more grand juries or more whatever it is. I mean, so there's always a balancing test.
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead, David. Then we'll get back to our callers.
I think we want to be careful about using volume as an excuse for not to be fair. And I'm not suggesting that's what you're saying, why we do it. But we have an enormous number of arrests. What we ought to be doing up front is looking at a lot of those arrests, particularly in the drug area and so on, and say, why are we making those arrests in the first place? Why are we clogging the system with those kinds of cases? And not so much in Philadelphia, but you look around the country, it's not only at that part, but there are many situations where it's a plea mill, right? It's a plea bargain mill. Lack of public defenders, lack of appointed lawyers, no cases are investigated. Prosecutor comes in, says, your client's in jail. You can plead guilty today. He'll walk out after a week in jail, or you can wait 3 months for a trial. Well, what do you think your client's going to do in that situation, even if he's innocent? So there are huge problems in our system because of underfunding, both on the defense side and prosecutors, lack of resources. And then everybody kind of assimilates the notion, well, we've got tens of thousands of cases. We've got to dispose of them as if they're cookies on a treadmill, right? That's what we're producing instead of justice. And we can see what's happened as a result of that kind of phenomenon over the past 30 years.
Let me get Denise from Clayton, New Jersey, to join us. Hi, Denise. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I just have a quick question, or maybe just a comment. It has to do with, I was on a grand jury, similar to Marlene, I was on a grand jury some years ago in New Jersey. One of the things that I kind of, at the end of my time with that grand jury, what I found was that the prosecutors, when they prosecuted a case, and this has to do with the race aspect of it, when they were presenting their cases before us, one of the things that I noticed is when a person that was being prosecuted, or it was an indicting jury, when the person was being prosecuted or whatever, their race was not mentioned. However, if they were Black, Hispanic, or any other race other than white, it was presented. And I felt that that was a little bit of a bias from the standpoint of a prosecutorial process. what I'm trying to find out is there any way to standardize that so that that does not happen?
Right. The issue of race, I guess the race of a defendant, Seth Williams.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's just a part of American history that is unfortunate that, you know, when people come to the courthouse, the first question that many people have is the race of victims and defendants, and they think that they can understand things because of that one question, which clearly they cannot. So, you know, I try to do all that I can to ensure justice. I'm a citizen. I grew up in Philadelphia. I saw racism, you know, and as almost every Philadelphian has. And so I try to do all that I can to eliminate it. We can't eliminate it, but do all that we can to hire people that are going to be fair, hire people that will make the district attorney's office resemble the demographics of the city of Philadelphia, the various languages that people and religions of the city. It's just difficult. People come with their own prejudices. So we have to do all that we can.
I understand. And as I said, I presented to the prosecutor when we were finished. I went up to the two or three people that had come before us and said, you know, you present this in this fashion. Is there any way for your office to change how you present it?
Right. That's a great point.
And did they have a response to you, Denise?
She said she had no – well, the one person that I spoke with, she said she had no idea they were doing that.
Oh,
interesting. She didn't realize it, even in her own language, and she was a white prosecutor.
Well, that's interesting.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's fine. I'm just looking at the clock, and I'm looking also at David Rudosky.
Yeah, so it's – you know, it's a very interesting observation. And, you know, sometimes when you look at that situation, you could think that's either deliberate, intentional racism. More often, it's implicit bias. And we've learned a lot about that. People don't even know it.
As
the DA said, people come in with their own prejudices, whether it's race or class or religion. We all have that. Oftentimes, we're not conscious of that, but it's affecting important decisions that are being made. And, you know, it's hard to root out. We ought to realize it. Police have it. Lawyers have it. Doctors have it. Journalists have it, no doubt. And the first step is to understand that phenomenon and to understand that we're all affected by that. And then think in institutions, right, where that can surface, where that can really have problems, police community relations, right, prosecutors, judges, lawyers, to try to take steps to reduce the impact.
I mean, more soul searching than some kind of standardized way of presenting information. You're saying that,
right? Yes.
Seth, let me raise something else with you. It has nothing to do with what we've been talking about. But as we know, three prosecutors who worked for the Attorney General now in your office, Mark Costanzo, Frank Fina, and Patrick Blessington, they have been caught up in this Porngate scandal, as it has been called. They had one day of sensitivity training.
Which I attended as well.
Which you attended as well. And they also are doing, I think, different jobs than what they were doing before. We're talking about confidence in the system. There are also calls from some members of city council that these men be fired for some of the racist and misogynist email that were sent back and forth. One, you know, hot ghetto mess was one of the subject lines. Can you tell our listeners confidently that this issue is being addressed within your office?
Definitely. There's been a very, very serious process of evaluating all this information. But again, it stems from a source, the Attorney General, who released these things piecemeal just to retaliate against these three as a result of the successful prosecution of Jerry Sandusky, who deserved to be prosecuted, as a result of her getting all types of her legal problems, her releasing these things. So what I've asked for is a release of all the emails of all these employees. What's important
to
recognize –
But we do know that these three men were certainly –
So three – yes, these three men, while working at the Attorney General's office more than 5 years ago, two of them were merely the recipients of ignorant emails. The standard can't be that we fire people that are the recipients of ignorant emails, or else the employment numbers in America unemployment numbers would be like 90%. How many of us have received idiotic, ignorant emails that were unsolicited? Almost everyone. So I have to ensure these people get due process too. And so I'm trying to do that. I'm trying to ensure the public, though. I've listened to council members and have taken them out of roles in which they are evaluating active criminal cases, but we're still utilizing their more than 60 years collective experience to help us with our criminal justice system, with our civil cases and our appellate cases.
Yeah. We're almost out of time here, David.
Yeah, I would just say one thing on the email scandal, putting aside the district attorneys that may have been involved. What really is troubling about that is that the judges on the Supreme Court were communicating with adversaries, right? Sure. I never got emails from I never got emails from any of those judges. And so to get the email to get the email from someone like that is really troubling in our system of justice.
Well, we could go on. My thanks to both of you for talking about grand juries and this issue as well. David Rudowsky, civil rights attorney, criminal defense attorney here in Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us, as always, on Radio Times. Seth Williams, Philadelphia District Attorney, thanks for joining us as
Thank
well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
Thank
you. You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour, Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.